You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 20th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, a taste of Argentina hits the screens here in London.
If you really follow the 11 features we have this week, they're all, you know, in a section, in a particular niche. I would say that it's worth to go and see.
That's what the actor whose film kicked off the Argentine Film Festival had to say about it. But today we'll ask what the critics think with Karen Krasanovich.
And art takes a vital turn as we look at two blockbuster exhibitions in Europe, Life and Death in Pompeii here in London, and the birth of the Renaissance in where else but Florence.
Plus we'll be hearing this. We'll be hearing much more as well in today's music review as we talk about how you promote music.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
So we have a very packed show to bring you today. Before that, Gillian, your cultural highlight of the week.
Oh, well, I have a prop to show you because I have a gingerbread candy-covered pointe shoe.
Which is very beautiful.
And my highlight is the National Ballet of Canada came to London for the first time in 26 years.
Bringing quite an astonishing production.
Well, an astonishing production and one very close to my heart because, first of all, I've always been passionate about ballet, but passionate about Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. And what was interesting about this, for people who love Romeo and Juliet, we're kind of, many of us are sort of wedded to Kenneth MacMillan's choreography. So this was a brave departure, very new choreography by Alexei Radmansky, and it was magical for all of us who were a bit doubters. We thought, you know, don't mess with it. It's perfect as it is, and so I was a little skeptical. But as soon as the curtain rises and you hear Prokofiev's music, you suddenly realize it's good to have new interpretations.
The fact that they've brought it to London, and like you mentioned, the Kenneth MacMillan production is the production that everybody measures Romeo and Juliet by. It was a big gamble by the National Ballet of Cali. Very brave.
It was very brave, and also some of the critics here were kind of questioning, do we need another Romeo and Juliet? But I think good for them to say, yes, we have an incredible troupe of dancers. We want to stretch our dancers, and what better way to stretch them with a classic and reinterpret it? So it was magical.
Who was the audience for it?
Well, you know, they say that technically maybe it would be a production that will interest younger ballet fans or younger people who may not be fans of the ballet. But I cast around and it was, you know, from lovely grey-haired couples holding hands who obviously have been to the ballet for decades together, to some, you know, young leather jacketed youngsters. So no, it was a good mix, and I think Canada's ballet was celebrated that night.
My cultural highlight of the week was Pompeii. We will be talking about that a little later on in the program. But Gillian, you mentioned young leather clad youngsters. We have Karen Krasanovich standing by to bring us her tay in on the Argentine
leather
Film
clad
Festival.
And all.
So we'll be back in a moment for that. So we start the show this week in the land of film, as I just mentioned, because currently across London, the second Argentine Film Festival is taking place. It's been running here in the capital since Wednesday at three locations, and it seeks to explore Argentine culture from clichés to secret communities.
And it also includes short films from young Argentine directors and a special programme of short films showcasing the country's rising music stars. And now here are some thoughts from Charlie Arturola, whose film kicked off the festival last week.
Argentinian film is so healthy today, thanks to Berlinale and San Sebastian and Napa Film Festival and the Poland International Film Festival and so many others. You find that there's a new breed. There's a lot of talent. I'm talking about guys in the late 20s, early 30s, that they come from an incredible school of filming that you get to learn a lot. I have to say, if you really follow the 11 features we have this week, they're all, you know, in a section, in a particular niche. I would say that it's worth to go and see.
That was Charlie Arturola, whose film El Camino del Vino kicked off the festival this week.
We had a lot of fun welcoming Charlie into Midori House on Wednesday. Do have a look at our website if you want to have a revisit of that particular interview. It's on Midori House on Wednesday. But it wouldn't be the review without a bit of a critical perspective. So to give us her opinion and talk us through some other new releases is the regular review contributor Karen Krasanovic back in the studio. Thank you very much for coming in, Karen.
Wonderful to be here, and it's wonderful to see both of you.
Yes,
looking
on
terrific
a Saturday.
And a beautiful day.
A girls' team this morning.
It's nice.
Tell us about the Argentine Film Festival. It's the second one that's been running so far.
That's right. Well, I think what's really important, it's so easy to be distracted by world cinema because there's so many different countries and the, you know, technology, the artistry is burgeoning all over the world. And Argentine films are particularly worth looking at. And I know that sounds a bit snobby and a bit particular, but I don't want to say they have a better film sort of aesthetic than other cultures, but essentially that is what I'm saying. But they have wonderful, wonderful visuals and a terrific storytelling history.
Is there a lot of competition? Like, do the Mexicans or the Brazilians, do they really try and be the star of the continent when it comes to contemporary cinema?
Well, yes, I think there is a lot of competition, particularly where I discovered Argentine cinema was at the San Sebastian Film Festival, where I just wandered in. You know, the wonderful thing about being a film critic, you don't have to really look and see what you're going to go and see. You just wander in, sit down and see what happens. And I discovered this fantastic Argentine film called Il Auro, and El Auro, because I can't speak Spanish, Argentinian Spanish, not even that, which was absolutely amazing by Fabian Bielanski, who sadly died shortly after that film was released. He's also famously did Nine Queens, which is one of the best, one of the best films ever made, but also one of the greatest Argentine films. I think that there's certainly a production element involved. I mean, Mexico's having production problems because of the security, but they do have a wonderful, a rich history. Brazil, you could look at all sorts of South American countries and their industries. But I think Argentina particularly, I would say of any of those, go and see an Argentinian film.
Where do you start? Because we have the golden age of the 1930s and then obviously under the junta, it all goes away and all changes.
Yes.
But then as recently as, 3 years ago, The Secret in Their Eyes got an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. So it's clearly an incredibly resilient industry.
Very much so, very much so. And I think that there's a lot, I mean, it has a huge history of culture, of art, of visual art, particularly cinematography is very, very strong. And I think, where do you start? You start with 2009, why not? and then work your way back or forwards, if you like. The history, it's very difficult to go wrong with Argentinian film. For example, The Man Next Door, which is one that, I mean, I did think The Camino del Vino was absolutely delightful, and I'm very pleased that you had the director on. This film is a black comedy, a social commentary about intelligence versus street smarts, and that's absolutely brilliant. And there's two more days left of the Argentinian Film Festival, and I urge people to go to the website and have a look and see.
Let's talk a little bit more about The Man Next Door. First and foremost, its setting. And
yes.
Where they have been allowed to film is breathtaking, isn't it?
Well, it's that I'm always going to say this wrong because I'm, you know, I've got this stumbling American thing where I travel as much as I can and I still say stuff wrong. the film was entirely shot at the Casa Curuchet, I hope I'm saying that right, which is the only residential house built by Le Corbusier in the Americas, which I think is astonishing. And it's actually essential for telling the story because it's all about art versus street smarts, in essence. It's won a lot of prizes, this particular film, and the cinematography is absolutely amazing. And it's the fourth by the two film. Why don't I have the director's names down here? This is very shocking. All right, just talk amongst yourselves.
Mario Cohen and Gaston
Thank you very
Depress.
Much. There we go. Thank you. Well, you came to my rescue. Isn't that nice?
Well, the internet did. The premise of this film, set in this Le Corbusier house, but in actual fact, the chief scene of action is the hole that the resident's neighbour wants to knock in the partition wall.
It's very absurd, yes.
It's silly.
Because the one chap lives completely in darkness, and the other one lives in light, and the one goes puts a sledgehammer right through his door and goes, you know, I want to make a window here so I can basically watch the rest of you living and get a steal all your light.
So it gets a voyeurism aspect to it.
Yeah, well, yes, you could say that. There is that element. But it's really the absurdity of economic situations. I mean, that's the broader thing. You could say it's been likened to kind of a more serious Jack Tati movie, really. And it's highly absurd and very entertaining.
I did want to touch a bit on the Elvino film.
Camino de Vino.
Exactly. Is it a documentary? Is it a fiction? Where does the journey take us? Because it is a journey, no?
Yes, it is. It's kind of in between. I likened it as sort of the Argentina's answer to Sideways, which is a bit naughty of me. But it's about a man who, a wine taster, a winemaker that loses his taste, and it's fascinating because it's not a new film. It's been around for a few years, but I think it's very indicative of Argentina focusing on what we know about it. I think it's a wonderful introduction to the country. Did I answer that question? Did I answer it?
But is it a journey? I'm trying to work out if it's a documentary or a fiction.
It's kind of in between, I would say. Yeah, it's both and it's neither. If that answers your question.
We're obviously straddling huge genres in Argentina there. We have the, like you said, the sort of the Tati-esque absurdist of The Man Next Door. Then we have docudrama. I watched a rather strange documentary called The Lost World Cup.
Oh.
Did you see it?
I missed that one, but it looks very interesting.
It was reasonable. It was a collection of interviews strung together to bring a narrative of an amazing story of the fact that the World Cup was cancelled during the Second World War. And so Jules Rimet decided that he wanted to create the equivalent of a World Cup to try and act as a deterrent for war. And the only place that wanted to do it was South America, was Patagonia. And there was no documentary evidence of this film ever taking place until a skeleton was found in Argentina of a man holding a film camera. And it turned out that the camera contained footage of the 1942 Patagonian Jules Rimet Cup. And it's a brilliant story. The only trouble is it's actually quite slowly told. Mm. It's told without narration, so it's just clip followed by clip, and it goes everywhere. You have Italian, Spanish. You even have British listeners will be quite astonished to hear that Gary Lineker plays a part in it as well.
He gets everywhere.
He gets everywhere. Does that Mr. Lineker? But it tells a great story. Whether it's actually brilliantly realised is a different matter. I'll leave it for you to look that one up. But what I thought about when you just mentioned there the things that Argentina is great at. You think about wine and then you think about football. Mm-hmm. So which subject matters do you think Argentina is focusing on in terms of film? Is it what we all think they might be focusing on?
No, not really. I mean, you get something like The Secret in Their Eyes or Nine Queens. And it's the general, what we're all interested in, you know, crime, psychology, what's going on between. Yeah, great storytelling. Sometimes taking a little, not a hectic approach, maybe not a linear approach, maybe not Western hurried, Western, that's wrong, but maybe not American, North American, okay, Hollywood-focused pacing. But it's got a different kind of pace, a different storytelling history.
You talk about Hollywood, but Nine Queens, didn't they turn that into a Hollywood movie?
They
so I
did
think
indeed.
Hollywood does go look for the ideas there.
You know, Hollywood is always looking for something that is really, really wonderful in another country so they can take it and see how far they can kick it as well. So not always with great success.
Well, all 11 films of the Argentine Film Festival are being shown currently in the British capital, London, so do go and check it out if you can. While we've got you here, Karen,
yes.
You wanted to talk about a few other films just in case you were short of something to do. I'd imagine you have to be really quite short of something to do to see the films that you've brought in. Let's talk about Love Is All You Need.
Right. This is really interesting. This is a Danish film, and it's got Pierce Brosnan. Again, the wonderful thing about being a critic is that you can just wander in and you don't really have to know anything, and then you wander out knowing everything, which is great, and it's painless. It's basically the story of a Danish mother and wife who lives in a kind of an abusive relationship. This was actually called The Bald Hairdresser, I believe, in Danish.
You haven't sold it to me yet.
I haven't. I'm getting there. Give me a chance. And she discovers that her husband's cheating on her. Her children are, you know, furious at this. Her daughter's getting married to, turns out to be, Pierce Brosnan, who is a lemon grove. grower, she's going to marry his son. Now, the children have only known each other, well, the teenagers have only known each other for, you know, a very short time. They're getting married on this in this beautiful Italian villa, surrounded by lemons, of course. And of course, lemons are the bald hairdresser's favorite fruit. It is fruit, isn't it? Yes, thank you. Or a berry, perhaps. We learn this. It's a story of Brosnan, who's I believe, a widower, who is hardened by life. He doesn't really want to be open to any sort of life balance. Everything is his work. And he meets this woman at the wedding. And everybody's life is transformed. And it's quite beautiful. It's sort of like Mamma Mia without the exclamation mark.
I was going to ask you that. Let's have a little listen. Do we have a clip of it?
Love Italy. The food, the wine, the romance. Don't you?
No.
You haven't said one nasty thing to me in over 6 minutes.
You really think I'm that angry?
Yeah.
Vi kan jo godt være en bar på Berlin.
Nej, hold op, det er ikke nogen, der vil.
Philip, why didn't you come over here, darling?
Benedicta, please. Your voice would wake the dead.
And that was Love Is All You Need, featuring Pierce Brosnan. Karen, you just mentioned it was Mamma Mia light. Is it?
It is. It is. It's... But people are really liking it. This is the kind of thing you can take your mother to. Anybody that's easily offended.
I was thinking of the Marigold's Hotel as well. Is it that kind of...
It's better than that. I really hate that film. That's such a waste of time. I'm sorry. It's got wonderful performances. I shouldn't diss British cinema. Stop it. But it's delightful. It's a delightful, light, frothy... And the central actress, I'm looking desperately for my notes. I've got a new iPad and everything has gone walkies on it. She's brilliant. She holds it together. She's a credit to our gender, I have to say,
Does it work? Because it's directed by a Danish director. Yes. So part of it is in Danish, part of it's in English. Sometimes that's a bit risky. It can be like a pudding.
It does seem a little odd. It does seem a little odd, but you go with it because you realize that cinema is becoming more and more global. And you go, hey, sometimes they're speaking Danish and sometimes they're speaking English. As long as the subtitles are there, we're okay.
It is so one of those things that you have to pay a little bit more attention.
You do, that's right. You can't, and particularly if you're going to watch it on DVD, you can't do anything else. You have to sit and watch it. But it's fun, it's frothy, it's light. It has some important messages about forgiveness and tolerance, and also knowing when you need someone and knowing when you don't.
Light, fun and frothy. That is the Love Is All You Need with Pierce Brosnan. Light, fun and frothy, our next and final choice, Karen. The Promised Land is not, is it?
No, it's not. I feel very passionately about this film. I've watched it several times, which is unusual for me. Matt Damon was supposed to direct this. This is an environmental message movie, which automatically people are turning off the radios. But it's about fracking. And we all know what that is. That is where you basically put high pressure chemicals and water into the shale beneath ground soil. I don't know how far down it goes. And this is supposed to release natural gas. Now, this story is set in a desperate farming community in America. And these people are struggling. The farms are no longer supporting the families. These people are really, really desperate. And yet they want to hang on to this lifestyle. So Matt Damon and Frances McDormand, his partner, his business partner, I might add, come in. They work for an energy company, and they're trying to sell this idea to the desperate farmers.
Obviously, it's an issue film, which I always find rather troubling because you always end up trying to work out what point the director is going to make. Mm. And this is a Gus Van Sant film. And,
it is.
And he's brilliant at making points discreetly. He's very, very good.
Maybe a little too discreetly in this one. Yes, yes.
How does the issue arise in
issue,
this?
Issue, issue. It's all, yeah. It's guitared with the issue, actually. You can't miss the issue. But it's not imbalanced. You can see both of the arguments, why we might need it, what's dangerous about it. And the interesting thing, I don't want to give too much away, because I think this is one of the most underrated films I've seen released this year. Granted, I haven't seen all of this year's. But Matt Damon was supposed to direct this. He didn't. It's got tremendous firepower. Gus Van Sant is not a slouch when it comes to making emotive, subtle films. But you come away from this actually feeling more confused and more hurt about the subject, which is good. It makes you think. It is not pablum.
Is it a bit in the vein of Aaron Brockovich or...
No. I mean, it is. But you come away really thinking, I want to know more about this. Mm. It doesn't tell you what to think.
We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Karen Grozanovic, thank you so much, as ever, for joining us on The Review. If you're in London, the Argentine Film Festival is on until Sunday, so to find out more or just to see what films are on offer or the ones we've just been talking about, go to argentinefilmfestival.com. In the meantime, stay with us here on Monocle 24. Up next, we go globe-hopping with Nelly Gotcheva.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Monocle are excited to announce the arrival of our newest space in London. On Marylebone's Chilton Street, the Monocle Cafe will be serving a selection of pastries from Lanka, the finest freshly ground coffee from Allpress to get you through the day, and more besides. So, if you're looking to break up a day's shopping or start the day with a meeting and a great cup of coffee, pop along to the Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street, Marylebone, London, 7 days a week.
You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, and Emma Nelson, where it's time now to jump on board our cultural private jet with the wonderful and wise Nelly Gotcheva to enjoy a few stop-offs around the globe.
In Lisbon, the Indie Lisboa Film Festival has taken over the Portuguese capital until the 28th of April. On show are 245 international films spanning from fiction and documentary to animation. On Sunday, visit the cinema São Jorge to see French documentary La Rivière Inversée by Sophie Valero. Or go for the Portuguese offering Forbidden Room by Emmanuel Nevado and Ricardo Almeida. For more details, go to indielisboa.com. If you're in East London this weekend, head down to the Whitechapel Gallery to see the work of Romanian artist Gert and Iuve Tobias. The exhibit features 37 pieces, including a selection of colourful modernist paintings, wooden sculptures and ceramic pieces. The exhibition is on until the 14th of June. The 31st edition of Art Brussels kicked off earlier this week in the Belgian capital, presenting 182 galleries from around the world. On our radar are galleries Nev Istanbul and Kyoto's Super Window Project. Also, don't miss Dubai-based gallery Isabel van den Eind, representing the best new artists coming from the region. For more information, visit artbrussels.be. In Hong Kong, design meets art with London-based dealer Circa, bringing its beautiful array of vintage furniture and home accessories to the city. Setting up at creative studio The Space in the heart of Shung Wan, the pop-up boutique features a careful selection of rare pieces from the 60s and 70s by the likes of designers Willy Rizzo, Maison Charles and Studio Janssen. The venue is open daily from 11 a.m. to 1900. As for the music, this weekend we'll be listening to San Francisco's The OCs with their new album, Floating Coffin. Let's hear No Spell. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That was No Spell by the OCs, not spelt how you think it is. Ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
And it's time now for our weekly music review. And as discussed on this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, the last 10 years have seen a seismic shift in the state of the music industry. Bands have gone from selling millions of LPs with tours essentially set up to promote them, to giving away albums online, building audiences with tracks placed on adverts, and making the bulk of their revenue through live performances.
The live music scene is well and thriving, however, and our next guest is in the centre of it. Rob Waller is the founding director of Soundcrash Productions, a live music agency which specialises in hip-hop-tinged electronic music, promoting future-thinking shows from London to the Adriatic coast of Croatia, which is where they run the now very well-regarded Soundwave Festival. Rob joins us on the line. Thank you very much for coming on to the review, Rob.
No problem.
Tell us how you first got involved in promotion.
Well, my background was in marketing and design, and you know, just had a general interest in music. And the opportunity arose to put a few bands on to begin with about 10 years ago, in a kind of small ad hoc kind of way, really. And I just saw the space for a lot more concerts in London. And yeah, things have grown very, very quickly. And I think, as your introduction said there, that things are thriving in the live music industry in London, especially.
Where do you see the new frontiers now? If you're looking to the sort of future of what you do, where do you see the opportunities?
Well, from my point of view, I think there are new markets opening in Asia that are quite interesting at the moment. British music has always been exported all over the world very successfully, and I don't think anything's changed recently in that sort of area. And we're looking at potential festival opportunities in the Far East and Australia as well. So, but the homegrown market still remains strong. You know, regional shows are thriving, and I think the only sort of area that isn't sort of going all guns at the moment is probably the British festival scene.
Which is quite ironic, I would imagine. You've taken your trade to Soundwave on the Adriatic coast. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, we were seeing a trend sort of evolving about 5 or 6 years ago of people wanting to combine their festival experience with a holiday experience. And I think off the back of some very sort of muddy, rainy experiences that were quite well publicised over the last few years, that it's really taken off sharply. And
so flip-flops instead of wellies.
Exactly, yeah. It's a bit more of an attractive picture for people, I think.
To what degree do you actually end up just putting, because you're promoting and because you're organising festivals, is a massive temptation there just to put your favourite acts on?
Yeah. it's quite difficult to steer away from that. I think there will always be an element of that, and as long as my favourite acts sort of combine a lot of other people's favourite acts as well, then we're all good.
Well, we're giving you a chance today to indulge in playing some of your favourite music. You've suggested about three or four tracks that you wanted us to hear. The first one is Ghost Poet and Meltdown. Why did you choose that?
Yeah, he's a very interesting new artist. He was nominated for the Mercury Prize last year and has been sort of building sort of quite sort of steadily over the last couple of years. He's sort of blending sort of urban poetry, hip-hop, and some electronic music there, and with a sort of folky kind of aspect. I just think it's really interesting, and there's nothing else out there quite like it.
So. Let's have a listen.
Sure.
Second guessing yes and no. Blood pumps regular, but skin feels icy cold. The flat's older, melting with the parts. So it won't be forever then. Can't do forever friends, cause something in my character just takes a hold and throws me out the car.
And that was Ghost Poet and Meltdown, the choice of Rob Waller, our musical guest today on The Review. Rob, that had a sort of really lovely, edgy, dark sound to it. We're going to move to something a little bit more chirpy now. This is Alice Russell and Breakdown. Tell us why you've decided you want us to hear this so much.
Well, this is somebody who's put on recently, and I just feel like Alice has some amazing energy, really positive music, one of the best soul voices, I think, around in Britain at the moment. So it's really as simple as that.
And was this track on the soundtrack for a movie, I gather, with Channing Tatum and Matthew McConaughey? How important is it for musicians now to get their music adopted by either TV, commercials or film?
More than ever, really, with the kind of formula that exists for artists to find any kind of financial success, that generally has to be... that side of thing has to be looked after. It's never been so important. The sales from records are very, very low, I think you mentioned before. And, you know, you can't play a concert in London every week. So touring and licensing are the two main revenue streams.
Well, let's have a listen to her now. This is Alice Russell and Breakdown.
That rhyme, unfamiliar journeys, misspelled signs, I'll fold my positions, flip all the time.
She's a staple on the Monocle 24 playlist with her collaboration with Quantic. She's recently worked with David Byrne and Fatboy Slim. She's a very busy lady indeed. That was Alice Russell and Breakdown, the choice of Rob Waller, today's music guest on The Review. Rob, we were talking about the new emerging ways of promoting music. What is the hardest part about being a promoter?
The hardest part about being a promoter? I think probably fitting everything in. It's a crazy exercise of multitasking to the extreme, really. We organise all of the events that we put on, so there's the management side, plus obviously the marketing side, and just literally everything, just, you know, liaising with the artists, etc., and just bringing it all together. So... There are a lot of challenges there to sort of make everything work together.
And what is it, when do you feel you really get it right? What to you is the kind of ultimate success or satisfaction?
I think just being in one of your shows and, you know, there's 5,000 people there, everybody's having a great time. Financially, you've made some money and, it's a very satisfying experience.
Let's move on to another one of your choices, Rob. This is Bonobo and Towers. Why have you decided you want us to hear this?
Well, this is off the new Bonobo album that's just out. And he is doing very well at the moment. He's selling out very large shows all over the world. One of the best new, not so new now, but one of the best sort of exports in electronic music that I think we've had in the last decade.
Let's have a listen.
Silence, erase.
that was Bonobo and Towers there, the choice of Rob Weller, who's the founding director of Sound Crash Productions and the Soundwave Croatia Festival today. Today's music guest on The Review here on Monocle 24. Tell us a little bit more about the Soundwave Croatia Festival. I mean, you said that your absolute high is creating a beautiful place that people can go and listen to. Why did you choose Croatia in particular as an emerging market?
I think Croatia, it's been on the map for the last sort of 5 or 6 years. And I think for people looking for an alternative to the, you know, sometimes a bit too crazy Ibiza scene or, you know, a lot of the Spanish or Italian kind of resorts, I think people wanted to, it seemed like people wanted to merge the more sort of adventure tourism side of things with a music festival. Croatia's, you know, it's got a very different history and path, and it is one thing to go to. An independent traveller, and so I think that brings a whole different element to the experience.
No, we're just about to say we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We're going to, your line seems to have decided that it doesn't want to let us talk to you anymore. So what we're going to do is we're going to say goodbye to you. Before that, could you introduce your last track, which is Andrea Triana and Darker Than Blue?
Yeah, another fantastic track, and one of Brighton's greatest exports. Andrea Triana, a great talent for the future. Keep an eye out for her.
Andrea Triana there and Darker Than Blue, the final choice of today's music guest, who is Rob Weller, founding director of Sound Crash Productions and also the man behind Soundwave Croatia, which is on this year in July.
Time now to cross to Paris for our weekly cultural city guide today. Our man in the city, Tom Burgess Watson, is here to guide us through it.
Why not begin your weekend in Paris with a little music? Marking the half century that's passed since Edith Piaf died, a musical show entitled Une Vie en Rose et Noire tells the story of this, France's most loved singer. Critics say it's like turning the pages of a biography about Piaf, and even the most ardent fans say the reproduction of her songs do her justice. Well, on Saturday there are two showings at 5 p.m. and 9 p.m. at the Théâtre d'Honneau in the 2nd arrondissement. Gallery 2 at the Centre Pompidou is hosting a retrospective of the works of the avant-garde artist, architect and furniture designer Eileen Gray. The creator of the Bibendum chair, which is one of the most iconic pieces of 20th century design, had strong links to France, and she lived here on and off until her death in Paris in 1976. You've got until the 20th of May to see the designs of this unconventional Irish aristocrat at the Pompidou Centre in the 4th arrondissement. What Watching a documentary film about France's national radio broadcaster might sound like an unlikely way to spend an hour and three quarters this weekend, but Maison de la Radio by the French director Nicolas Philibert has been given rapturous applause by the critics, and it dazzled audiences at the Berlin Film Festival. It's showing at a number of cinemas across Paris, amongst them the UGC Orient Express in Châtelet.
La frite s'obtient d'une pomme de terre, épluchée, coupée en lamelles.
Fraîchissant nord-ouest 4 à 5 le matin, mer agitée, des pluies. Pour Fortis,
France Bleu, bonsoir, quel est votre prénom?
Et la question rouge déjà.
Just open this weekend, the Louvre is displaying 30 paintings, drawings and sculptures by the Florentine artist Giotto, bringing together pieces from mainly French collections, but also from further afield. Well, entitled Giotto e Compagni, or Giotto and his assistants, recalling the people who followed the itinerant artist, this exhibition is on in the La Chapelle room of the Louvre, and it runs until mid-July. And finally, at the Opéra Bastille, the American choreographer John Neumeier directs 2 hours of contemporary ballet set to the Austrian composer Gustav Mahler's Third Symphony. Well, given the calibre of the dancers and their director, this spectacle is wowing the critics. It's on at the Paris Opera House in the Place de la Bastille in the 12th arrondissement. For Monocle, in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
That applause, of course, was for the ballet at the Paris Opera, but also for Tom Burgess-Watson, our man who brought us up to date for what's happening in Paris. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Back after this to compare two landmark, dare I say it, blockbuster exhibitions in London and Florence.
Come with us from
Georgia
before we zip to
Istanbul
on Route 4 as we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in, that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
And welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Gillian DeBias and Emma Nelson.
Now, it's been billed as the hottest ticket in London this summer. Life and Death in Pompeii is the latest exhibition to be staged within the British Museum's gorgeous rotund reading room in the centre of the Great Court. It's generated advanced sales of more than 100,000 tickets and inspired a healthy increase in the number of tourists heading to southern Italy this summer. The exhibition contains some items never before removed from their ashy homes in Pompeii or Herculaneum. So was their journey worth it?
And also to look forward to this summer is a new exhibition in Florence, The Spring of the Renaissance. This is showing at the Palazzo Strozzi until August and then moves to the Louvre in Paris until the end of the year. This show attempts to bring together the magical early moments of the birth of the Renaissance. And someone lucky enough to see both exhibitions is the critic Jasper Rees from theartdesk.com, who joins us now in studio.
Hi there.
Where do we start? These are
exactly.
Two huge, huge exhibitions.
Should we begin at the beginning?
Let's go to Pompeii then.
With Pompeii.
What were your thoughts on it initially? It's before we describe what it, before we go into what how good it was. It's divided into two sections, isn't it? Both obviously life and death.
Life and death. You certainly feel that you're in the presence of death when you go there, because the first thing you see is the upturned, writhing body of a cast of a dog. which was obviously tethered to a wall and was unable to run away. And the exhibition closes with this extraordinary collection of human bodies, again, casts, a whole family, all exhibited in close proximity together, found in presumably, exhibited in the positions in which they were found. And their agony is absolutely tangible. It's quite extraordinary. But in between that, life absolutely bubbles up in the most kind of vibrant and celebratory way. You really feel that you're in the presence also of people who really knew how to live.
I mean, it says the life and death of Pompeii and Herculaneum. It's really about life and daily life, everyday life, the small details, isn't it?
It certainly is. You what's extraordinary about it is that there are a lot of exhibits that are sort of powerfully mundane. I mean, they're really, like, I think the most mundane thing in the whole exhibition is a pair of tweezers, which you wouldn't think twice about when they're sitting in your bathroom. But when you know that they've been sitting underground for 2,000 years and are being exhibited in the British Museum, or hydraulic fittings. Actually, that was the one moment where I thought, I think I can pass on the hydraulic fittings. But there's some wonderful things like a weight in a kitchen weight in the shape of a sow, or a kitchen mold in the shape of a hare, so that people can have their pâtés or their pies or whatever shaped like a hare. And one of my favourite ones was a boundary marker for a freedman, i.e. someone who had been a slave, called Marcus. And it says, inscribed on the wall, it says, "This is the wall of Marcus, private and in perpetuity." And obviously, perpetuity turns out to have been more accurate than he knows.
It is an astonishing portrait of everyday life. And it's not just the, like you say, the mundane elements of it, but the artfulness about which the residents of Pompeii and Herculaneum went about their daily business. You get these wonderful, wonderful murals. There are dozens of them on the walls, almost so many you don't even know where to start. But there was one wonderful one that was above a pub, I think, and it charts basically a brawling evening. There's a couple kissing, yes. And then there are two men playing a game, an early game of backgammon, and then they have an argument about it, and the story is almost in cartoon form, punctuated with graffiti.
It does feel like a cartoon, doesn't it?
It's brilliant fun.
It is. It's one. Should we talk about the famous frescoes as well?
Why not? Go for it.
Well, as we know, Pompeii was a place where they did know, as I said, how to have a lot of fun. And there is one. The exhibition is set out in the form of a house. So you arrive in the hall and you end up in the garden. But you do go into the bedroom, and the bedroom is really, in fact, basically a series of artifacts. Well, certainly on the wall, stripped from a brothel.
They didn't have to rush in. It was warm.
Quite.
They knew how to amuse themselves astonishingly.
There are an extraordinary number of phalluses per square yard in this exhibition, which makes it a lot of fun. And of course, they have an entirely different attitude to what these things represent. They're not sexual symbols. They're symbols to ward off evil spirits. I mean, the fact is there is the one thing that's interesting about this exhibition, which you don't get when you go to Pompeii, is the stuff from Herculaneum, because Herculaneum has been is a much lesser known entity to most of us. And the interesting thing about Herculaneum is because the periclastic surge, I think I've got the right word, boiled everything much more quickly in Herculaneum. It meant that all things like leather and wood, this organic stuff, was carbonized instantly. So you have things from Herculaneum that don't exist in Pompeii, for example, that you've got a wonderful rocking baby's cot.
It's terribly sad.
I know. And other bits of wooden furniture, and this food that is like the bread loaf with a stamp which reveals who actually made the loaf on it, and pomegranates, figs, etc.
It has an amazing quality to it that when you walk round, like you say, the house as it is laid out, you are lulled into a very, very false sense of peacefulness and security. Mm. And everything is so beautifully preserved that you almost expect little char marks on the outside of it. But no, it has all been so beautifully maintained under this ash for centuries and centuries and centuries. That when you get to when you turn the corner and you get to the very small final section where you see the casts of the bodies, it knocks you sideways.
It is like a punch in the gut, isn't it? It is extraordinary, but it's an incredible, and it's done in an extremely tight space. You talk about the reading room in the British Museum. It's a compact area, and so you'll sort of you weave through this space, and it's very, very well laid out. I mean, beautifully laid out, so that when you get there, it does tell the story of Pompeii, of this place that flourished, was an extremely wealthy place, built obviously on Roman engineering plus slavery, and so you get to the end, and that is where they say all of these people died. And so death comes to us all, and death certainly came to the people of Pompeii.
It's interesting. It's billed as a blockbuster, but there's no shock and awe in the production values, but there is awe in the detail and the extraordinary civilization that, in a way, was frozen for us to know.
There's a lot more civility, it has to be said, on show than actually in wandering around, because it's so crowded.
It was a point I wanted to come to, actually. You say it was in a small space. Do you think it was perhaps in too small a space, or there is almost
there
too
is
much
a case
in there?
I can't disagree with that. I do actually recall, this reveals my age, as I was pretty small when I went to the Tutankhamun exhibition in 1972 as a tiny child. I remember queuing. This is in the days before the internet, before timed bookings, when you just had to queue to get into things. And I was taken by my mother, and we stood outside the British Museum for what felt like hours, and we got in there and saw the famous image of Tutankhamun, and I remember thinking, God, is that what we came for? it's the same level of excitement now. I suspect that the British Museum hasn't had an exhibition like that since, and this really does feel like a must-see thing, and they do release tickets every day, and you've just got to kill a granny.
I think you did. Well, there are plenty to kill, actually, in that exhibition. Thousands of grannies. It's one of those sharp elbowed exhibitions. So do go girded
and take a chill pill as well.
Let's have a drink. So another absolute must see, which we must move on to, is that you're recently back from Florence, where the Florentines are suddenly embracing their city like never before, aren't they?
Well, they are, particularly actually in this wonderful museum called the Palazzo Strozzi, which was taken under. It's got a new director who has been there. He's a Canadian. Well, he calls himself Anglo-Canadian, actually. But he has taken on the Palazzo Strozzi and turned it into this wonderful happening museum. And what they do when they have Florentine shows that have a Florentine theme is they give you a thing called, they call a passport. And it has lots of things they recommend you go and see in and around Florence and the region of Tuscany. And if you can get a stamp saying that you've paid to go into five or I think six things that are in the passport that are relevant to the exhibition, they let you into the exhibition for free. And boy, is it worth doing it for this one, the Springtime of the Renaissance, which is a most extraordinary exhibition. Most people think of the Renaissance as, if you want to be highly reductive, the visual signifier is Botticelli's Venus springing out of her shell. And this goes way back before that, to the point when the Renaissance, as we now call it, they didn't have that word then, really, really started in 1401, when there was a competition to design a panel for these bronze doors that were going to be put on the baptistry opposite the cathedral. And the two best entries by Donatello and Brunelleschi are on display there. And they're on display all over the place, because you can see copies of them in the Victoria and Albert Museum. But next door to them are the two pieces of classical sculpture which inspired them. So what this exhibition is saying is the Florentine Renaissance was about rediscovering classical virtues and classical aesthetics.
Which is something which is not often discussed, even though when you look at it, it's obvious when you think about it for half a second that, of course, they're looking back to Roman values, because it's all about the man is at the centre of everything at this point, isn't it? And suddenly you notice how art suddenly becomes incredibly human.
It does. And actually, I'd like to draw a parallel between the Pompeii Florentine Renaissance exhibitions. There's an extraordinary sculpture in the Pompeii exhibition of a man called Lucius, who was a banker who apparently may well have been a slave to start with. And there he is. There's a bust on top of a marble column, and he has a huge wart on his left cheek. And you would have thought, well, actually, maybe lose the wart, he might have said to the sculpture, but he didn't. And there's a thing also in the Victorian Albert Museum, which is on display in this exhibition, called the Cellini Madonna, which is a roundel, a bas-relief in bronze by Donatello of a Madonna and Child. And Dr. Cellini was given this by Donatello. He gave it to him in lieu of payment for medical procedures. And there is a bust later on in the exhibition of Dr. Cellini by another sculptor. I think it's Rossellino. And Dr. Cellini is depicted like the stubbly, like the warty banker Lucius, with all his stubble and his double chin, and it's an incredibly frank portrait. There's nothing idealised about it at all.
And so the saying, warts and all.
Exactly.
Jasper, I'm afraid we have run out of time. Jasper Rees from theartsdesk.com. Thank you very much
indeed,
as ever, for joining us on the review. Pompeii, Life and Death in Pompeii, is on until the 29th of September at the British Museum. You must book ahead, otherwise you'll never get in. The Springtime of the Renaissance is on at the Palazzo Strozzi until the 18th of August in Florence. Before then, it goes to the Louvre in September after that. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Our thanks to Katie Bilbao, our producer, our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amelia Jen, and our studio manager to Claire Urban.
And if you're in London today, why not pop down to Midori House, where the Monocle Shop Springsdale is taking place.
That's all from us on today's review. Goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.